Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Dr. David Patel, a junior research fellow at the Crown Center for Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. With a bachelor's degree from Duke University in economics and political science, and a doctorate in political science from Stanford, it's not surprising that Professor Patel's scholarly research includes a big dose of rational choice and game theory. But what is unique about his approach is that he combines this with ethnography and geospatial analysis to analyze the recurrent ability of Islamic institutions and symbols to shape patterns of collective action through the dissemination of information. Whew! Hopefully he will explain what all that means here in a minute. David is the author of several articles on the political economy of Islam and is currently finishing up a book tentatively entitled Islam, Information, and Social Order. This book is part of an ongoing research project that seeks to explain the emergence and decline of local social orders and national-level sectarianism in post-Saddam Iraq. David, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Hey, so tell me about this game theory, outer spatial analysis stuff, and a dose of ethnography. That, I mean, from my vantage point, that's a really novel mix of research approaches in the social sciences, and you don't see that all that often. So how did you fit all this stuff in your head?
I think it's just a combination of how I end up approaching questions and the sort of topics I'm interested in. I initially, as an undergraduate, focused on international relations at Duke, but took some courses on early Islamic history. And I got to say, I was just fascinated by this early Islamic period, the period of the rise of Islam and the spread of Islam and the contraction of Islam right after the death of the Prophet Muhammad. And I think my first dissertation proposal was to write an institutional rise of Islam, kind of like what North did for the rise of the West. I think eventually that's a post-tenure project because people told me there's no way I'll get hired in political science doing that. But I think that was kind of the spark for my interest in Middle East studies and Islam, and this was before 9/11 when interest in it was fairly low. But in terms of combining those methods, I think what I've just always focused on situations. I don't know if you want to call that game theory, but taking a complex world and focusing on some core situation or interaction between individuals that produces some outcome and understanding what people believe will happen if they do something different, right? Game theorists might call that the off-equilibrium path belief. But I think taking any sort of complex situation, breaking it down into that core situation and making it tractable, I think that's really where I start approaching almost any question. And that's when the turn to ethnography, game theory, and when there's spatial implications, geospatial analysis comes in.
Geospatial. I think I called it outer spatial. Yeah, I thought you were doing stuff on the moon or something. But what is geospatial analysis? I have to admit here that we're in the middle of a job search at the University of Washington, and I'm seeing more of these methodological terms I've never seen before. So all you young'uns got some, you know, fancy methodological tools out there that you're using, and one of these is geospatial analysis. What does that mean?
That's a good question. You know, I think it's just a fancy word for saying that we should think about space and take space seriously. I think in political science, actually across disciplines, right, not just in the social sciences, but even in the humanities, I think we're much better thinking about time and incorporating time into our analysis. In political science, we tend to talk about path dependency. Historians are obviously all about time. But spatial thinking about where things are or where they happen, in taking seriously the relative locations of social phenomena, I think is still in its infancy. And so when I say geospatial analysis, that's part of it. We tend to equate it with a set of tools like GIS to visualize spatial patterns, to help organize data, maybe to extract a new column for a data set analysis. But I think more generally, it's thinking about spatial concepts, distance, proximity, exposure, access, these sort of things. And I think we're really just at the beginning of of a tremendous amount of work, both in social sciences and humanities, that's thinking about space and using some of these new techniques.
And so did you do that in your work? You just mapped out different areas? We'll talk more about what you did in Iraq as part of your research project in a little bit. And I can see where you would be out going from neighborhood to neighborhood just to map where people went to a certain mosque or something. So are you doing a lot of that mapping stuff?
I wasn't initially, right? I went to Iraq with this theory, and I was doing research there. And I ended up having to leave, and I assume we'll talk a little bit about this, as violence got worse and worse in 2004. But while I was there, I realized that my theory had some spatial implications. So I didn't start with that approach or knowing anything about GIS, actually. I just realized that my theory had implications. If my theory's right, I should see order. I should see more order in these sorts of areas than in those sorts of areas. So there were spatial implications. And the way I think about it is there were just more ways to test my theory, right? More ways to get some leverage on making causal inferences. There were spatial implications. And so when I ended up leaving Iraq, I had those kind of spatial ideas in mind. I had collected some data there on where local councils emerged. So I had some maps of local councils, which now I would call polygons. I had an idea that mosques created order in a geographic catchment area, and I could think now of different concepts of how I would visualize and think about a catchment area, a buffer around mosques, which are points, right? And see, I'm starting to transfer these ideas, like a mosque and a catchment area, into a spatial concept, like a catchment area from a point. And so I think, again, learning GIS after I left Iraq helped me take some of this material I'd collected there, think through it in a more systematic way, get some more leverage on those spatial implications. And then I stumbled upon this data set of what's called the SIGAC data set, which is a data set of events, attacks that occurred in Iraq, murders, and I use that to use a measure of order. I use it to get a sample of murders that occurred in Basra and test some implications of my theory on where murders occurred and where they didn't occur. So I didn't start with that approach or really that method or those tools. I developed them later in order to assess some of these observable implications.
Yeah, that stuff's pretty amazing. And the fact that you go back and learn it, you know, us older scholars look at all that new technology and we get pretty scared by it. So it's good that we have new blood coming into the profession teaching us all this stuff. I really, really appreciate that. And it is a cool way of doing it. You're solving a problem. You're not getting wedded to one type of methodology at all. And another type of methodology that you use is somewhat unique in political science. And I'm wondering if people raise their eyebrows when you said, well, I also do ethnography, because that sounds to us political scientists who like all the math stuff and you're trained in economics, that's the soak and poke anthropology thing where you just kind of hang out for a while and write the diary about it. So what is your ethnographic approach here?
You know, Fenno did a disservice to the discipline by calling it soaking and poking, right?
Yeah.
There's this classic book in political science, for those who are unfamiliar with it, where Fenno, who followed around some members of Congress, he said what he did was soaking and poking or just hanging out. And this is when it comes to ethnography, this is the one thing that everyone in political science reads. And unfortunately, it's kind of shaped how we think about ethnography. You know, that idea of just hanging out, that has one role in what you could call the scientific exercise. When I say ethnography, I mean participant observation. And participant observation for me means immersion. Not all field work is participant observation or immersion, right? A lot of people stay in hotel rooms and go and do formal interviews and leave. But I think of ethnography as really getting close to people, getting them comfortable with you being there, and trying to experience their lives and how they live as much as possible in order to understand things from their perspective. And this plays a lot of different roles, right? The classic role of ethnography, at least in political science, is for, I don't know, systematic empirical description, maybe descriptive inference. And that's useful when we're kind of collectively ignorant or we need to just understand the details of a case. Or it's used for theory building, for generating new ideas, hypotheses, developing hopefully falsifiable hypotheses that can be tested elsewhere. But I think people who do ethnography well can use it also for theory testing. And I think this is why ethnography has a reputation in political science that it does, is that it's not as used for systematic theory testing as it could be. All of our theories have observable implications, and some of those observed implications are best conceptualized and measured and data collected on them through participant observation, through immersion in people's lives. And so I don't like when ethnography is called soaking and poking. I think when you think about what role it can play in the scientific enterprise, part of that is soaking and poking. But also it can play these other roles as well.
Well, that is some stuff that we're going to be getting to here. And what you do very well is get down into the dirty world of politics and of violence and all that kind of stuff in your research. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. But I want to first start off with a paper that you wrote for a journal called Rationality and Society that deals with the phenomena of veiling. And this is a rather interesting phenomena that you observe has been growing in recent decades, not only in the Middle East, but throughout the Islamic world, around the globe, and including here in the United States. And you see female veiling, and that includes everything from full body covering to, you know, what you might see in Afghanistan, to basically just a headscarf in Turkey or maybe on U.S. campuses. And I want to start with this first because I do think this leads into your other project in Iraq, and it's interesting too, ethnography, that you're looking at people doing things at the micro level that we might not normally observe, but once you start to get into that world, that ethnographic world a little bit more, you start to observe some things. So let's start talking about that. And first of all, how did you get into this study of what the article says, concealing to reveal, the informational role of Islamic dress? How did you get that project?
Well, first, let me mention, when people say veiling, they're oftentimes confusing all sorts of things. And you mentioned that huge variety in mm-hmm. what you could call traditional Islamic dress. So some of it is just a simple headscarf, which leaves the face uncovered, which is usually called a hijab. And then there's more conservative, for lack of a better word, forms of veiling, where the entire face is covered in a niqab or a burqa. There's different parts of the Muslim world have different traditions. But typically all these things get caught up and are called a veil, which is very misleading because a lot of them don't cover the face, right? Which is, when I think of a veil, I think of that versus a headscarf. I came to this question because I've basically been going to the Arab world at least every year since about 1998. And what really struck me is there's places where I went to, and even in that time period, you saw not just more people covered, more women covered, but more women covered in more conservative ways of dressing. So there's an enormous literature, a huge literature on how Arab societies and Muslim societies, some people claim more generally, came to readopt this hijab, what they call the re-veiling movement. It's a little misleading because it wasn't women who previously veiled putting it back on. It's usually a generational change. Women who never veiled now putting on a simple headscarf. And that's what they focused on, the headscarf. Huge literature on this, that it has to do with economic changes, creating a way for women to enter the workforce, lower middle class women to enter the workforce. Islamist groups gave selective incentives in some places. For some places, adopting the hijab became a sign of anti-regime protest or as a protest against westernization and commodification of their societies. So huge literature on why women adopted the hijab. What there's very little literature on, though, is why then did some women not stop there?
Yeah.
But then continue to adopt more conservative forms of veiling. And what I do in this paper is I take a signaling model and argue that as more and more women adopted the hijab for all sorts of reasons unrelated to piety, those women who were already wearing the hijab because of piety suddenly could no longer show people that they were pious just by wearing the hijab. It was now a noisy signal, right? So they had to adopt higher cost signals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what you do here is combine the tools of game theory and the ideas of pooling and separating equilibrium to create this, you know, interesting story of almost a chess match that is going on. You get the early movement toward re-veiling and more modest dressing and stuff, and so that makes it difficult for those who were doing that before to signal that they are different than everybody else, and it just ups the ante even more.
Well, they have to adopt higher cost signals, and those higher cost signals are full face veils, maybe gloves. I also say this rise of female pietist movements, where women are publicly pushing for a space to pray in mosques and to study the Quran in mosques. This could be interpreted along those lines. And here's what's kind of cool. I should say cool, but typically when you see this change, this escalation in conservative dress, it's seen as a sign of ideological change, that there's rising fundamentalism and that there's this increasing spread of what we call Salafism, which is this ultra-conservative form of Islam that says go back to the original founders, the original few generations after the Prophet. It's associated oftentimes with the Islam of Saudi Arabia. What I can show in this paper is that you can see this escalation in Islamic dress without any underlying change in piety. The less pious don't need to become more pious, and the already pious don't need to become more fundamentalist to see this I don't want to call it a peacock type behavior, where you have this expansion of conservative and costly dress. Right, that's the key thing. This dress is costly, and for the model to make sense, it has to be sufficiently costly for less pious women to adopt, and more pious women adopt those costly clothing in order to make a credible signal now. So there was a pooling, there was a separate equilibrium, and then it broke down, and that signal was no longer a credible signal piety, so they had to find new, more costly signals.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are they trying to signal out here? I mean, you're signaling piety, but why is that an important signal to send?
So in the paper, I link it to the marriage market. But this is, you'll never hear a political scientist say this probably, but you understand a country's marriage market, and you're a country expert. That's the single most important thing you can understand about any society or culture, is understand marriages and how people select mates and how families approve or disapprove of certain types of marriages. And so I link it to the marriage market and the desire of families to marry their sons off to pious women, mm-hmm. or a sufficient number of them willing to marry their sons off to pious women.
And why? I admit, I have not heard that. I'm one of these people who dips my toes into a lot of weird type of analysis. So thinking about the marriage market, I know all about Gary Becker and his work on marriage markets and the economics of this. But to say you want to understand how people or how a society works, you need to understand the marriage market is absolutely fascinating. I usually tell my students that you want to understand how governments tax and defend their borders. That's kind of the core there. But explain it. Go into that a little bit more about why marriage is so important in society.
Well, remember, in a lot of societies, obviously, the ability to reproduce the family provides social security, not just for this generation, but previous generations. It's the core of how many societies end up thinking about the unit, right? The relative unit isn't necessarily individuals, it's the family. But cultures get preserved down here. A lot of the things that we study in terms of religion or what we'd call cults, those are oftentimes reproduced by family units. But I think more fundamentally, you just look around at the way we dress, the way we talk, the majors we pursue, what we value. A lot of that is related to the ability to get married, to get married well. I don't want to take it too far.
Yeah.
But you know, political scientists need to read more Irving Goffman.
Okay. Well, I'm going to put that on the list. We'll link to it on the website as well as some of the stuff that you've written. So who is that, Irving Goffman?
Oh, a sociologist. His daughter is now famous because of this book On the Run, his older work on presentation of self. I'm a rational choice scholar, but perhaps the fundamental motivation in everyone's life is to avoid humiliation.
That works out perfect within a rational choice framework, I would argue.
Yeah, exactly.
And you do a very good job with this issue about signaling, and dress is obviously the most obvious way that we do this on a day-to-day basis. Again, it seems to be background noise to people, and we never really notice it. But when you think about it very carefully, a lot of what we do, how we dress, sends out signals. And again, if you're trying to signal, hi, I'm really pious, I have a certain vision of the future family that you might want to share, and those of you who don't, please stay away. I think that's obviously can fit into a rational choice framework very easily.
It fits with men too. I mean, when you walk around, I spend a lot of time in Jordan these days, and you can tell a Muslim brother versus a Salafi. You can tell their political viewpoints as well by how long their beard is, by the type of shoes they wear, by how long the bottom of the outfit goes. There's all these small little signals. And you go to Israel, obviously, tons of information is conveyed in kippahs, the type of kippahs people wear.
Yeah. Give us some example about that, because again, this is something that most people from the outside really wouldn't observe, but these subtle signals become very important within the culture itself.
It's funny, this paper, this hijab paper that we're talking about, I submitted to a political science journal, and it was rejected. And one of the reviewers was very clear, this has nothing to do with political science. And the editor suggested I send it off to a sociology journal, which they thought it would more appropriate. It's interesting that the sort of questions that we define as appropriate to our discipline and not appropriate to our discipline.
Oh, let me tell you, I have heard that. And I have published in Rationality and Society, and I think I got the same reviewer. Actually, there's probably many of them that said, this is not political science. Would you please go to sociology somewhere? You know, and that's how I ended up publishing some of my stuff in Rationality and Society. So, yeah.
I was lucky in that. I did my PhD at Stanford at a time and with a group of people where nobody asked me that question.
Mm-hmm.
It just really wasn't that relevant. And there was a shared interest on part of a lot of people to understand these sort of strategic dynamics. And they saw that as traveling across different areas, whether it was about politics. There are commitment problems out there. There's coordination problems out there. Those are the things that travel. So when you talk about generalizability, it's not necessarily generalizing this to other clothing styles. It's about those strategic dynamics that travel.
Okay. Yeah, no, you were very blessed to be in that environment at that time. And I had the same thing at UCLA, that we were very interdisciplinary, and it really is liberating, freeing up your mind, allowing you to not only have different tools, but to think about different questions, and that is what you do very well here.
For me, though, one thing that was very good, though, is I went from Stanford to Cornell, and I was an assistant professor at Cornell, where it's a decidedly different sort of department. And so I was surrounded by Sid Tarrow and Val Bunce, and I had to realize if I believe what I believe because I believed it, or I had drunk too much of the Kool-Aid out of Stanford. And so that was actually very good for me. I hadn't been exposed to a lot of social movement theory, constructivism, the way IR scholars understand it. And I developed a much better understanding of what I knew and what I didn't know, what I hadn't been exposed to, and the limits of a lot of the game theoretic arguments I had pushed, I think, too far often.
Yeah. But again, you are very multidisciplinary, and that takes us to the next point that I want to talk about, and that's your book project that's entitled Islam Information and the Rise and Fall of Social Orders in Iraq. And I love this book. Now, you're still working on it, crossing the T's and dotting the I's, so to speak. But it's a wonderful read. And you open the book with a little vignette about looting that occurs in the spring of 2003 in the city of Basra, which is in southern Iraq. Why do you open with that story? Why is it important? And what kind of doors does it open to your analysis?
So I spent almost a year in Iraq, living with an Iraqi family and studying post-invasion Iraq. And what's really stunning about Iraq is when the U.S. invades, the Iraqi state collapses. But when I say the state collapses, we focus a lot on the banning of the de-Ba'athification process and the dissolution of the Iraqi army. But within a week of the U.S. invading, the Iraqi state disappeared. Every government building was looted. And when I say looted, they weren't just taking furniture or desks. They were ripping wires and windowsills out of the wall. So the entire apparatus of the Iraqi state, every trash collection facility, every police station, every government building, every courthouse was looted to its foundations. So what's interesting about post-invasion Iraq is it's a case of state collapse. But it wasn't state collapse like you saw in Afghanistan, which never had a strong state to begin with and slowly broke down over time, or elsewhere. When states fail, they usually fail slowly. And as states fail, as states stop collecting taxes, as they stop providing goods and services, other actors are able, and organizations, fill that space. International organizations, local organizations, political groups, people figure out ways to trust and cooperate with one another to substitute for the state. In Iraq, that didn't happen. The state collapsed very suddenly, overnight, literally overnight. And so if you're interested in the origins of institutions, how people come to cooperate in the first place, I don't want to call it a state of nature because we obviously we'll never see a state of nature. But it's a nice example that's closer to it than most of the other situations you could imagine. And so I start with that in the book to give you a sense of how the state collapsed. And again, going back to what I said initially, understanding the situation that Iraqis found themselves in the day after the U.S. invaded, and a week later when it became clear that the state had stopped picking up trash, the state had stopped providing water, electricity had crumbled, and that the coalition, the U.S.-led coalition, initially under Garner and then the CPI under Bremer, was either unable or unwilling to get things going again, and that Iraqis, if they were going to have some sort of order, were going to have to do it themselves, and then how they did that.
And this is, as you mentioned, this is a great opportunity. I mean, it's a sad moment in history, but it's a great opportunity for social scientists to really understand how people build social order and build it at the grassroots. And that is what's really unique about your project. A lot of political scientists spend a lot of time talking about high politics, about, you know, how are we going to write the Constitution, all these things. But the people who were in the neighborhoods of Basra at that time were dealing with real basic things, as you say, picking up the trash. That doesn't seem like something a high-minded political scientist should be thinking about, but it's incredibly important and an indicator of how a society actually functions. So tell us a little bit about the nature of the decay of social order, why it's important, and more importantly, how people react to this once a state collapses rather rapidly.
Well, I don't know if you'd agree with me on this, but social order is very understudied in political science.
Oh, I agree with that 100%. Yeah.
even in sociology and other disciplines, it is. And I'm talking out of my element here, but it might be the previous generation. They associated a concern for social order with conservative political movements, and they were more interested in how societies were governed instead of the extent to which they're governed. I don't know how many PhD programs still read Huntington's Political Order and Changing Societies. They've all moved on to the third wave of democracy. Maybe we're moving back to social order now, but I think it was largely ignored for several decades, and I think there's slowly a return to it now. I mean, you look around at the television shows I watch now. I don't know if this is appropriate to our conversation, but The Walking Dead, mm-hmm. Game of Thrones, those are about social order. Mm-hmm. When society breaks down, when the state collapses, how do people come together to reproduce order, and what different forms of order might arise? I think that's a central concern of our world right now. I think people look at the news and they're interested in social order. They may not call it that, but it's the problem of our time.
Yeah, I have to butt in here too. You mentioned some television shows, and I watched a little bit of The Walking Dead. But you're absolutely right. I mentioned this to students to, you know, connect with popular culture and stuff, and I agree with you that social order is really understudied. But it's really fascinating because it is the stuff of Hollywood movies. My favorite television show to this effect was Deadwood, which was, you know, back in the 1870s in South Dakota, where you had basically no state and a lot of wealth that people could just grab and take. And so you can imagine a chaotic world, but somehow, and you see this over the course of the 2-year series, they build social order and you build it at the grassroots. And you're absolutely right. I don't think political scientists have been studying that adequately enough. Economists have been doing a little bit better at that than we have. And you're bringing in some of the tools of economics into it, and your influence of, you know, Barry Wongast and Avner Greif and other folks like that, it obviously comes through. So tell us what's happening in Iraq this way.
Okay, so the argument I make is that a week after the state collapses, trash is piling in the streets. And remember, this is a city where the temperatures get to 120 degrees regularly. It's famous in medieval Arab poetry for its flies and for its horrid smell. Water stagnating in the streets. Sewage is leaking out into the streets. Conditions are pretty bad. What happens is Friday mosque preachers stand up and just start saying, here's how we're going to prioritize our issues locally, and here's how we're going to solve them. Now, here's what's phenomenal. Shia Muslims had not held Friday prayers in Iraq for about 50 years. Shias don't have Friday prayers in general, and we can get, if you're interested in the details of why not, we can talk about it, but really it has to do with the legitimacy of holding prayers, Friday prayers, the Friday communal prayer, and when the imam, when the Mahdi isn't present on earth. So in Iraq, they had stopped holding him in the 50s. There was one time in the late 1990s where they were restarted in one small mosque network associated with Muhammad Sadiq al-Sadr, a grand Ayatollah who was killed in 99. But the take-home point is there were no Friday mosque sermons in Shia mosques throughout Iraq until the Friday after the U.S. invaded. So when Shias go to the Friday mosque or hear a sermon, for the vast majority of Iraqis I interviewed, it was the first time they ever went to a mosque sermon. What happened is I argue in the book is that these Friday preachers, they had a unique ability that no one else in Iraq had. They had an ability to deliver a message and to deliver the message in a way that everybody living in a spatial area, in a location, heard it and knew that their neighbors heard it. That's the key thing. It wasn't just that they delivered the message. They delivered the message in a way that rendered it common knowledge. I know that you know that I know that you know. And this work is built off of work by Thomas Schelling, and you mentioned Michael Che and others who thought about coordination games. And so people turn to the mosque. They turn to those preachers, not, I argue, because of any pre-existing legitimacy or authority or salience of kind of religious identity. They turn to the mosque preacher because that mosque preacher had a unique institutional and informational power, a capability to render messages common knowledge. And so it helped people coordinate with their neighbors. We're going to all throw our trash over here, or we're going to dig out the ditch just in front of our neighbor, in front of our individual homes to keep the sewage flowing. And what happened is, from week to week, they get these messages. And it wasn't a back and forth, right? This isn't what you could call civil society developing, where people are debating and discussing. This was a message coming from a pulpit to a community that was receiving it all at once. Iraqis ended up coming to rely on those mosque messages to know what other Iraqis living nearby knew. And so here what you're seeing is this is the origins of a new institution, an institution in the sense of an equilibrium pattern of behavior. And it also explains the origins of legitimacy. That legitimacy of these preachers was not pre-existing. It was produced through this interaction, through this process of interaction. So much of what you might call institutional analysis takes individuals' incentives to follow rules or institutions as exogenous, right? There's a veto power, and we can look at the power of that veto power. There's very little work that actually looks at how individuals' incentives to follow a rule or a leader is endogenous to the interaction. And that's what I try to do here, explain the origin of the institution and endogenize the origins of authority, and in this case, religious authority.
Okay. I'm going to push back a little bit on this because I think you say that, you know, the formation or creation of a new institution. And it's interesting that you say that the clerics did not necessarily have legitimacy to begin with. I wonder if that's the case, and maybe it's an empirical question. You can give us an idea. I'm sure there's a lot of people who didn't go to mosque, and then, you know, 2 weeks later after the collapse of the state, saying, you know, maybe we should listen to this guy because he's the focal point of coordinating our behavior. So I can see that. But for me, it's not so much the creation of a new institution, but is it an institution that wasn't impacted by a collapse? Okay, so when the United States Army comes in, religion as an institution, these mosques, they still exist. There's nothing that affects their organization when the U.S. military rolls in, but they're the only ones that can come in and substitute. So many people are piggybacking upon these institutions rather than creating these things wholesale new. What are your thoughts there?
Well, they do things. People like to say that when the regime collapsed, there was a vacuum of authority, and then religious leaders filled that vacuum. I can tell you, as somebody who's on the ground, it may seem like it was a vacuum, but it was actually a cacophony of voices. There were hundreds of groups and organizations yelling 100 different things. So some people were telling Iraqis, look to Arab nationalism. They were repeating things they heard during Saddam's time and appealing to Arab national symbols. There were lots of Iraqi national symbols. People were flying flags in Basra that flew during the pre-Ba'ath Republic era from 1958 to 63, trying to say we should rebuild a society based on Abdul Karim al-Qasim's vision. There were local authorities. So a local judge in Basra said, I'm going to use oil and I'm going to make Basra a new Dubai within 5 years. Just think of yourself first and foremost as a Basrawi. Other people were saying, no, it's your tribe that really matters, or it's the global community of Muslims, or it's the Shias we should take care of first. So there were lots of different actors all saying different things. We can't just say that these guys had legitimacy, and we know they had legitimacy because they were followed. I think we need to explain why they had legitimacy over rival actors. And even if you want to say, of course, it's natural that Iraqis turn to religion or turn to their sectarian identities, there were a lot of different actors claiming to speak for Shias. So Iraqis were hearing their local mosque preacher, but they were also seeing what are called Sada, Sayyid families, these descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, who in Iraq traditionally had been local arbiters and influential figures. They were saying, listen to us. You had preachers from abroad who didn't have mosques, but had transnational networks who were saying, we're back now, we're going to take care of you. There were Islamist parties coming from Damascus, coming from London, coming from Iran, and we hear about these parties today. Dawa in Basra, there were several Dawa parties. There were new parties that had been underground that came up. There were repressed Islamist organizations that resurfaced. There was the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. So in other words, there were a lot of different actors speaking for this identity, Islam or Shiism. We need to explain why certain actors became powerful and not other ones. And that's a good theoretical account is able to do that. It's not just to explain for the rise of this cleavage or this identity, but a lot of other smaller observable implications as well. And I think the theory does a pretty good job doing that.
So go ahead and explain that then. Lay out your theory here of why these groups of individuals were able to organize better than the preachers from abroad or the Sada families or the Dawa, etc.
So all these other groups were coming back. They were putting up signs everywhere. They were hanging. They were holding rallies. They were distributing money. And those rivals had a lot more resources. Right? They had a lot more experience. They had organizations. They had a lot more guns too. But people turned to those mosque preachers because those preachers, I argue, had one thing that others didn't. They had an ability to generate common knowledge in a geographical area. And at the time, that's what Iraqis needed most in order to solve local coordination problems. But here's the other thing. The power of those preachers was limited just to coordination dilemmas, not to solving collective action problems. So coordination is different than what you could call collective action that's subject to free riding. A coordination game is just, as long as a sufficient number of other people are doing something, I want to do it. This is radically understudied. Political scientists, economists, they tend to just say, they give the example of what side of the street you drive on. I think a lot more things in life are coordination dilemmas, right? You said you're doing a search there at Washington. The candidates who are going to show up to give a job talk aren't going to wear jeans and a t-shirt. They're going to show up wearing dress pants or a blouse, and if they're a guy, they have a dress shirt and a tie, because we've coordinated on that as a signal of a serious person. I think the clothes we wear, the way we talk, a lot of the ways we interact are coordination dilemmas. And I argue that a lot of these things that we would think of in Iraq as public goods, they were people were able to provide them through simple coordination. But what preachers were not able to do was solve collective action problems, which are situations where even if other people are participating, you still have an incentive to free ride or not to participate. If you think these preachers had pre-existing authority or legitimacy or the power of Islam, then you'd expect them to be able to solve both coordination problems and collective action problems. And I found that preachers were only good at solving the former, not the latter. So again, the theory not only accounts for the rise of religious authority, but also it allows us to deductively restrict or constrain the authority we should actually see. So they weren't all powerful.
That is an incredibly interesting point, and I have to applaud you on that, because as you're talking about this, thinking back on the political economy courses I teach, you slip between coordination problem and collective action problem fairly easily. I try to differentiate them a little bit, but we do conflate those two quite a bit. And for you to actually see this from the ground level, that preachers are very good at solving the coordination problems. Okay, people, this is where we're going to put all our trash, or this is how we're going to get the water running again. And instead of the collective action problems, has huge implications for society moving forward. Because if you can solve the coordination problems, but not the collective action problems, society's going to look a lot different than if you can do both of those.
Exactly. And so what I've been talking about so far is just the local level. The second half of the book then moves to the national level. This local coordination was happening around both Sunni and Shia mosques. And that's where the GIS comes in. I use GIS to blow up catchment areas around mosques and then look at where order was provided. I look at murder rates near mosques, near one Friday mosque, versus areas of overlapping Friday mosques, so areas equidistant between two Friday mosques. But what the Shias had that the Sunnis did not have was an ability to then coordinate messages across mosques. So the Shia clerics in general, Shia Islam, is very hierarchical. You have these guys at the top, grand ayatollahs, who control networks of preachers or agents. They're called wakils in Arabic, in various places. So it's similar to the Catholics, but it's not as formally designated, and you have multiple popes, each with their own network. Iraq has one very large network controlled by Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who's an 80-year-old shut-in. He never leaves his house. He doesn't speak in public. If you want to look at authority, our theories of authority, we still go back and refer to Weber. He doesn't have much charismatic authority. He controlled this very large network. And so what happened is, over time, he piggybacked on this already existing authority that local preachers were generating to start coordinating messages across Shia mosque sermons in his own network. And what happened is, Shias going to a Friday mosque affiliated with Sistani came to know what other Shias listening to the same sermon in other Sistani mosques throughout the country were hearing, right? This is a micro foundations of an imagined community. Knowing what people whom you're never going to meet know and think about things. And this allowed Shias to coordinate on national level issues, on solving issues related to the Constitution, on voting schemes, even though they weren't thinking of themselves as Shia. Sistani's messages were never, do this as Shia. It was always, this is for Iraq, this is for all Iraqis. What's tragic, though, is the Sunni Arabs who were going to their own Friday mosques, Sunni clerics are much less structured. There's much less hierarchical authority among them, and they're more horizontally organized. And so Sunni Arabs never developed an ability to coordinate messages across mosques. So what you saw is coordination among Sunnis remained very local, just around the mosque, not across mosques. And Sunni Arabs increasingly failed again and again to come up with unified positions about the conditions under which they participate in elections, about constitution-level issues. And they found themselves left out of this developing, imagined community of Iraqi nationalism that was really rooted in a Shia a message that was being delivered by a Shia cleric, Sistani. And one final thing I'll say on this. When you talk to Iraqis, all Shia Iraqis, they'll say, anything Sistani says, I'll follow. That can't be true, right? In equilibrium, what we observe is Sistani issues messages through his mosques, and they're all obeyed. But Sistani knows what will be obeyed and what won't be obeyed. Coordination messages are obeyed. Messages that are subject to free riding will not be obeyed, and hence are never issued in the first place. Right? This is that off-equilibrium path beliefs that are driving the behavior. So it looks like Sistani is all-powerful, but that can't be true. Look at the condition Iraq is in right now. If Sistani was all-powerful, he clearly would have preferred a better outcome for Iraq and would have told Iraqis to do things that would have led to a more stable or better outcome. His power was also constrained, and it was constrained in this way. He was able to solve national-level coordination issues among Shias. So in that sense, the book, it's not really about Iraq. It uses data from Iraq and examples from Iraq, but I see it as speaking to these three much larger issues. And these are problems of enduring interest to political science. These come out of the canon of political theory. Right, we're talking about social order. This is Hobbes. It's the problem of social order. It's the problem of authority and the constraints on authority, the origins and limits of political authority. And finally, identity selection. How do people come to think of themselves as a community? What are the boundaries of that community? And who's in it and not in it? So I see it as a book really about those three big puzzles and how those three big problems and questions speak to each other in ways that the literature usually ignores.
Yeah, I have to give you three cheers for doing that, because the biggest fear that I have for your book, and you probably have it as well, is that everybody's going to see it as a Iraq book, area studies book just on Muslim politics. But the theoretical underpinnings of this really make it transportable, as you say, to, you know, Deadwood in the 1870s, South Dakota, to zombie apocalypse that'll be forthcoming in a few decades. I mean, this stuff is really, really, really important for all of political science, and hopefully that the book, when it comes out, will be pushed to the broad audiences of everybody in political science. So very, very excited about that kind of stuff. I have to ask you, though, and I know we were talking a little bit before we turned on the recorder here about going on the job market, and people, you were trying to tell people this theory, but all they wanted to do was hear stories of your field work. And I hate to say this, but I want to hear stories of your field work, because not only is your theory absolutely fascinating, but how you actually did the field work. You were doing field work in Iraq in 2003 when there was a war, when all this social order is breaking down, and you're studying stuff like increased murder rates and all that kind of stuff. I would have been just absolutely terrified doing this. So what's your experience just in the field?
So people have different risk. People have different risk acceptances, right?
Yeah, mine's really low. I don't like risk that much. Yeah,
mine's high, but I'm not suicidal. So
oh, okay.
I did leave as things got worse. But you know, I was lucky in that I had a dissertation advisor, David Layton, who I think lived vicariously a little bit while I was doing my field work. And so I was there with my girlfriend at the time, and we went across the border from Kuwait, and we ended up living with an Iraqi family. And so I was doing dissertation work. I was unaffiliated with the military or any occupation authorities. I'm not Arab background, but I look like I'm Arab, and so I could pass. I can go to mosque sermons and pray, and no one gives me a second look. I had my own car there, so I was able to travel around and go up to Najaf and Karbala and other places that typically you wouldn't be able to get to. And I think what really differentiates the work I did from a lot of other people who spent time in Iraq is that, as you mentioned, I'm completely bottom-up. I never really met any important Iraqi politicians. I couldn't get into the Green Zone. I went and knocked on the Assassin's Gate, and the U.S. soldiers wouldn't let me pass. This is the entrance to the Green Zone in Baghdad, because I had no business being there. So my work is very bottom-up. And what I found is that the things I was trying to figure out about Iraqi society, Iraqis were also trying to figure out. They were all just as confused as I was about what other Iraqis thought they should do in this new post-Saddam world. It was extremely confusing. And Iraqis did not have strong social networks or interpersonal trust or organizations to coordinate with each other and to know what other Iraqis knew. And so I found that Iraqis were just as much, the Iraqis I knew well were just as much interested in what I was learning and what I was hearing as I was, because they didn't know what was happening in their own societies. I went to Iraq at the time in 2003 because I thought this, the U.S. invasion was going to be the most important event in the Middle East in my lifetime. And I thought that for a long time until the Arab Spring happened. And then I thought that maybe it wasn't. But now I think, the so-called Arab Spring, I think, is better known now as the, in Greg Gause's phrase, the winter of Arab discontent. And with the rise of ISIS and the situation we're in now, I think that invasion really is the defining event of my lifetime in the region. And this issue of social order that I was investigating then is more relevant than I ever thought it was going to be.
So take us through that now, because much of your field research and the things that you're studying here really revolve around the state collapse in 2003 and, you know, roughly in a year or two span in that point in time. But your book doesn't stop there. It talks about the implications of what happens in the first several weeks, several months, several years. Rebuilding social order has implications that reverberate. So what has happened since that time in Iraq, and then also, as you mentioned, the presence of ISIS now, how is that impacting everything in the region from your perspective?
Well, so one of the reasons why I think it took me a long time to finish the book was because people were always asking me how my theory explains the last 15 minutes. There's a lot of really good work, a lot of great books out there about Iraq and about post-invasion Iraq that focus on the mistakes the Americans made, that focus on the political process, the writing of the Constitution, and then the rise of sectarianism. And I'm trying not to do that. I don't want a book that's going to just fit in the shelf next to them. Like I said, I want to speak to these larger issues. But I think some of those issues that I develop in there, especially on identity and about why Sunnis were less able than the Shias to develop a unified position on a lot of these national level issues. Those have real implications for today and where we're at today in Iraq. We assume there's a group. When people talk about Iraq, they oftentimes assume the problem is the issue of Sunni inclusion. How can you get the Iraqi government, which is perceived to be Shia-dominated, to bring in more Sunni Arabs? The thing is, there's tons of Sunni Arab politicians that have been engaged with the political process since 2003. The Iraqi version of the Muslim Brothers have always been in there. You have more Salafi religious Muslims, like Adnan Delaney's group, who've been involved with the political process. You have Iraqi nationalists, like Saleh Mutlaq. You have ex-Ba'athists, like Alawi. You have regional actors, right, from Mosul and from Nineveh, who represent regional groups. You have tribal actors who've been there. And all these different groups have participated in the political process, in the elections, and in Iraqi governments. In fact, after their last Iraqi elections, Sunni Arabs were overrepresented for a time being in the Iraqi cabinet, including with really important ministerial positions, like education and defense. But what you see is that the Sunni Arabs have never been able to basically overcome those internal divisions. They remain divided on all sorts of issues. And the Shias are just as diverse. They're just as diverse and just as internally divided. But what they have is that voice of Sistani, who can coordinate them through that process that I outlined that started really early on after the invasion, that allows them to take national level, to coordinate on national level issues, that allowed them to seize the state, in many ways define what this post-invasion political environment was going to look like. The Sunni Arabs remain fractured. They remain leaderless. Sunni Arabs in Iraq remain more a group in the minds of others than in their own minds. And I think this has created a space for ISIS to rise there. ISIS didn't arise in the past year or two. ISIS grew out of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and the Islamic State was declared way back in 2006, 2007 in Iraq, right? So ISIS, the Islamic State, the organization that we're talking about today, it dates back to 2006. And it took hold and was able to sustain itself in Sunni Arab majority parts of Iraq, I think, because of that internal division and because of the inability of Sunni Arabs to reach some sort of a unified position to have a role in this new Iraqi polity.
Explain what is happening with ISIS. You mentioned that it arises in 2006 out of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And so this is also an instance of having to solve coordination problems and possibly having to solve collective action problems as well. How have they been doing it different than other insurgent movements? Why have they been more successful over the past decade or so than some of these other ones?
Well, I'll say two things and focus really on, the Islamic State in Iraq was basically defeated in 2007, 2008 with the so-called surge. The U.S. allied with, in many ways, empowered tribal actors in Sunni Arab portions of Iraq to defeat ISIS. And ISIS, the group we call ISIS now, made a comeback with what happened in Syria, the collapse of the Assad regime in western Syria and the eruption of the civil war there, allowed ISIS a new lease on life. And what it did is it dispatched groups to Syria. And instead of trying to fight the Assad regime and overthrow the Assad regime and march to Damascus, what it did is it started governing territory. And it provided public goods, right? It became the sovereign. It became the Leviathan. And so it solved that problem of social order. And remember, parts of Syria and parts of Iraq where ISIS has flourished, these are areas that have had instability for, like you mentioned, a decade. What ISIS does is it provides order. It may not be your preferred form of order, right? But think about Hobbes. Hobbes says life is nasty, brutish, and short until you coordinate on selecting a sovereign. And all you have to do is pick one amongst you, and then everybody yields that person some coercive power. And then that Leviathan produces order. You may not like that order, but you prefer that order to no order. And so ISIS, in many ways, people who live under the Islamic State, it provides order. It turns the lights on. In Syria, the moment ISIS conquers your village, the Assad regime stops bombing you. The Americans might start, but Assad stops bombing you. It provides order in a place where, for years, they did not have order. We focus a lot on the foreign fighters in ISIS. A lot of those guys are cannon fodder. The people who are doing the, you can, there are a lot of different reasons people join ISIS. But a lot of the core fighters for ISIS, and certainly the leadership, these are local or mostly Iraqis and a lot of Syrians. These are people who ISIS provides them a salary, it provides them a job. Like in a lot of civil wars, families want to have one of their sons in the rebel organization that controls the region. Because if you have a son fighting in ISIS, if anyone in your family has a problem, you have some connection. You have wasta. You have somebody you can go to for help. So a lot of people are supporting ISIS because it does provide that form of order. The other reason is ISIS's leadership, ISIS uniquely combines a terrorist organization with military expertise. The upper leadership ranks of ISIS are filled with ex-Ba'athist intelligence and military agents. And these were the last few years of people to go through Saddam's military and intelligence agency security forces. These aren't much older Ba'athists. These aren't guys in their 80s who are steeped in secular Arab nationalism. A lot of these young officers are people who grew up in the 1990s in Iraq when Saddam launched his faith campaign. And so we still don't fully understand the impact of the faith campaign and the spread of Salafism in the Sunni Arab areas, but a lot of these Ba'athists seem to have been more amenable than previous generations of Ba'athists. And ISIS combines that military expertise with a terrorist organization. And they've done what no other, or what they did what Al-Qaeda was not able to do, and no other terrorist organization in the Middle East in recent years has been able to do, which is actually create what looks like a state. And they've, you can say that they're not real, they've declared a caliphate, and you can criticize it, you can say the vast majority of Muslims in the world reject it, which they do. But this is the most credible claim to the caliphate since it was abolished in the 1920s by Ataturk.
Yeah, and as you say, because they just do something very simple. They provide that initial social order amidst a lot of chaos. And that little step, I'm a public choice theorist, and so I'm thinking about James Buchanan here. It's just, you know, it doesn't matter how crappy the initial constitution is, so long as the initial constitution is better than complete chaos.
And notice religion, Islam, plays no role in that account.
Yeah.
It's not that important.
It can be a coordinating device and, you know, create a little bit of help with the identity. But yeah, that's a very good point. Just want to finish up here in the few moments that we have. I should point out that you've also written another piece that talks about how pundits here in the United States, as well as government officials and military advisors, are misrepresenting or misunderstanding the situation of ISIS. And we will link to that article and point people back to that. And you've covered some of the bases there. But what I want to do is for you to do a little bit of self-reflection here. And you've been studying this for, you know, more than a decade here, watching everything unfold and things unfold rather rapidly. Over that time, has there been anything that you've observed that really has challenged your priors about human behavior, about social life, that you went, aha, I never really understood that? I mean, tell us if you've had any aha moments and what they are like.
So I think anyone that studies the Middle East right now, other than being unbelievably depressed,
yeah.
I taught a course on Islamic politics at Cornell for years, and when I described Islamic movements, I would say that they cherry-picked elements of Islamic history and reinterpreted them in modern ways. And I said, this is why no Islamist organization has or will try to reinstitute slavery. I have to redo that lecture. I think I've learned a healthy dose of being humble and how much we actually understand. There's so many things I've gotten wrong again and again. I don't know if that's a single aha moment, but that's really it's really things I thought were going to happen, I was very confident they were going to happen, did not, and other things that I never thought would happen did. So that's one thing. There's two more things I'll say. One is that I remember a conversation I had actually in a mosque with somebody, and He knew I was very interested in Islam and the power of Islam to motivate people. And he made some comment. He said, "Dawood, you know, you're never really going to fully understand the power of Islam until you've accepted the revelation that God sent us through Muhammad and the power that has for us. And that's really struck with me, because it's something that it might be true, but I don't know if it's true, and I don't know how I would know it's true. And I oftentimes think about that conversation when I craft these arguments. I think we oftentimes like to completely dismiss religious motivation and make it completely about instrumental or a strict rational utility maximizing view. But I think being able to use that framework but still allow people to be expressing sincere and deeply held religious ideas and commitments in that framework, I think, gives us a much more accurate understanding of why people are doing what they're doing.
Yeah, I will say amen to that one. Yeah, as a economist of religion or a political economist of religion myself, people oftentimes think I'm boiling everything down to an instrumentalist view of religion. But I think that's true. We have to take religious motivations very, very seriously. And your last point.
It comes back to the earlier point about ethnography. It's really easy to go to a place and see what people do. You see the way people interact with each other. But I think the aha moments I've had are just, I don't know how to explain this without using game theory lingo, but just suddenly understanding the off the equilibrium path beliefs that are shared between them that are driving that behavior. So a really simple example is, if we're talking over the phone, but if we were standing face to face and you put your hand out to shake mine and I do not put mine out to shake yours, I'm violating some norm and some behavior, and you will infer things about me because you know that me not shaking your hand will convey an affront to you. Understanding that aspect, what people think about other people and what not doing a certain behavior implies, I think is, there have been all sorts of things I didn't quite get in a society until I understood that off the equilibrium path beliefs. And those are really hard to observe and to understand because by definition you don't observe them, right? They're off the equilibrium path. And so I think that's where spending time in the field and immersion really helps. You get a sense of those things you never observe, but that people know will happen if something's violated. That's really what drives these equilibriums and sustains them. That's what makes them an equilibrium. And so it's not just describing it, it's really understanding it. But the understanding is getting at that stuff you'll never observe. And so the small aha moments, I think, have been getting those things down and understanding them.
Yeah, as I call them in my classes, I call them life's little mysteries, just seeing these little things in daily life that we don't observe, we don't think about because it's just background noise or the way things always are, but become incredibly important. And this is why your work is incredibly important. We look forward to your book coming soon, which is, you know, the tentative title, I guess, is Islam, Information, and the Rise and Fall of Social Orders in Iraq.
Yes, but I've been told by publishers that I need something catchier, like Order Out of Chaos or something like that. So
that would be a cool title for a book.
The initial title was Ayatollahs on the Pareto Frontier, which I still like, but people don't know what Pareto is, and then the people who do know, they point out that you're not actually explaining movement to the Pareto Frontier. It might be towards it, but which is actually a good point.
Yeah, you would sell the books to about six people who understand that whole political economy, social choice kind of literature stuff. But Order Out of Chaos, I think I might like that one better. But we are definitely looking forward to this book. And if you were here in person, I would put my hand out for you to shake, because I think this is really, really incredible research, and I can't wait to see how it develops over the years, and we definitely will be in contact in the future. My guest today has been David Patel. David, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.